Today and possibly through next Wednesday, we're going to do a special for Independence Day, and it will center on the men of the Declaration. The 4th of July that we now celebrate today is the 240th anniversary of our founders issuing the Declaration to George III. Parliament also received this. 56 men from the 13 colonies signed the document and distributed signed copies, and that therefore fomented the Declaration of Independence to the British, and therefore the War for Independence. There are but a few men who are presently well known among the signers, such as John Hancock, John Adams, Samuel Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Richard Henry Lee, Francis Lightfoot Lee, and Thomas Jefferson. The names of the remaining 49 are relatively unknown, yet to a man these individuals brought sterling credentials to the debate in Philadelphia. Aristocrats, doctors, lawyers, educators, pastors, planters, businessmen, and military officers made up this distinguished gathering of highly educated and accomplished leaders of the fledgling Commonwealth. Now, I've selected one man from each of the 13 colonies for our study. Two of them are well known, John Hancock and Richard Henry Lee. The rest, most likely not. Each was chosen to demonstrate the high degree of honor, integrity, patriotism, courage, intelligence, ingenuity, and accomplishments these men possessed. They exemplify the types of men who gathered as one to participate in the founding of our republic. It is my intent that the synopses of these individuals' biographies will adequately illustrate and amplify the magnanimity of the men who stepped forward, debated, concluded, and then went public by signing their names to a document that fomented revolution against the mother country. And they did so with clear vision of the magnitude of their decision as they mutually pledged to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. The text quoted was written in 1848 by Benson J. Lossing and is typical of the writing style of the 19th century. As an introduction that gets us ready to note these 13 men, I have chosen each one of these from the 13 individual colonies in order to amplify the kind of character, integrity, and honor, not to mention the leadership and the mental perspicuity of each of these. They come from many different backgrounds, but each of them acquired a love for freedom. They were men of honor, and they were willing to sacrifice everything in order to acquire freedom for this country. In gratitude for this, before we begin this process one by one, we'll pause for a moment of silent prayer. And during that time, you can lift to the Father your appreciation and gratitude for the freedom we enjoy in our country and that we exercise today as we reflect back to the beginning of our client nation. And you also may use the time, if necessary, for rebound. Shall we pray? Heavenly Father, we're indeed grateful to you for the hour that we now have to study these concepts that reflect the integrity of these men. You brought them through a very tough patch, yet they succeeded in their endeavor, and we enjoy the fruit of their efforts. As we magnify these 13, it is our prayer that we will be focused on who they are, what they accomplished, and the wonderful result that we all individually and collectively enjoy. And we lift our prayer of gratitude in the name of Christ, our Savior. Amen. Our first is from this colony of New Hampshire. His name is Matthew Thornton. He was born in Ireland in 1714 and was brought to this country by his father when he was between 2 and 3 years of age. His father, when he immigrated to America, first settled in Wiscasset in Maine, and in the course of a few years moved to Worcester in Massachusetts, where he gave his son an academical education with a view to fit him for one of the learned professions. Matthew chose the medical profession, and at the close of his preparatory studies, he commenced his business in Londonderry, New Hampshire. And when the Provincial Congress was organized, he was chosen Speaker of the House in January of 1776. In September of that same year, he was appointed a delegate to the Continental Congress for 1 year and was permitted to sign his name to the Declaration of Independence when he took his seat in November. Dr. Thornton was not the only one to whom this indulgence was granted. There were several members absent when the vote was taken on the adoption of the instrument on the 4th of July, but who, approving of the measure, subsequently signed his name there too. In 1789, Dr. Thornton purchased a farm in Exeter, where he resided until the time of his death on the 24th of June of 1803. He was then in the 89th year of his age. And Dr. Thornton was greatly beloved by all who knew him, and to the close of his long life, he was consistent and zealous Christian. He always enjoyed remarkably good health, and by the practice of those hygienian virtues of temperance and cheerfulness, he attained a patriarchal age. This diagram here that you see shows a summary, pictorially, of who we're going to note. And you can see that Matthew Thornton leads off the 13. I'll go down here. I'll show you this from time to time. But this is a tight shot of the bottom of the declaration. This shows the signatures of these men. Now, it's too small for me to see, but a star sits to the left of each of the signers that we're going to note. I'll leave this up at halftime if you're interested in seeing each individual signature. We now move back to our list. And that's going to be, wrong way, Joe. It's going to be John Hancock. Everybody knows John Hancock. If you signed your name, people say, sign your John Hancock. One of the most distinguished personages of the War of Independence was Hancock, who was born near the village of Quincy in Massachusetts in the year 1737. His father and grandfather were both ministers of the gospel. His father is represented as a pious, industrious, and faithful pastor, a friend of the poor, and a patron of learning. He died while John was quite an infant and left him to the care of a paternal uncle who cherished him with great affection. This relative was a merchant in Boston who had amassed a large fortune, and after having given John a collegiate education at Harvard College, where at age 17 years he graduated in 1754, he took him into his counting room as a clerk. His abilities proved such that in 1760 he sent him on a business mission to England, where he was present at the funeral rites of George II and the coronation ceremonies of George III, who would become our future adversary. Soon after his return to America, his uncle died and left him at the age of 26 in possession of a princely fortune, one of the largest in the province of Massachusetts. In 1776, he was chosen a representative for Boston in the General Provincial Assembly, where he had for his colleagues some of the most active patriots of the day, such as Samuel Adams, James Otis, and Thomas Cushing. Years before Mr. Hancock entered into public service, the tyrannous measures of the British cabinet had excited the fears of American colonies and aroused a sentiment of resistance that long burned in the people's hearts before it burst forth in a flame of rebellion. These feelings were familiar to the bosom of young Hancock, for he imbibed the principles of liberty with the breath of his infancy. And when circumstances call for a manifestation thereof, they exhibit the sturdy vigor of maturity. And when Parliament adopted those obnoxious measures toward America, which immediately succeeded the Odious Stamp Act, Mr. Hancock was a member of the Provincial Assembly, and in unison with those patriots before named and others, he determined not to submit them. He was one of the first who proposed and adopted non-importation measures, a system which gradually spread to the other colonies and produced a powerful effect upon the home government. He became a popular leader and drew upon himself the distinct wrath of offended royalty. In 1774, the Provincial Congress of Massachusetts unanimously elected Hancock their president. The same year, he was chosen a delegate to the Continental Congress and was reelected to the same station in 1775. When during the summer of that year, Peyton Randolph left the presidential chair of that body, John Hancock was elected to the station, a gift the most exalted possessed by the American people. In that office, he labored arduously and filled that chair on the ever-memorable 4th of July of 1776. As president, he first signed the Declaration of Independence, and with his name alone, it first went forth to the world. Mr. Hancock continued a popular leader until the time of his death, and no one could successfully contend with him for office. He was not a man of extraordinary talent, but was possessed of that tact and peculiar genius fitted for the era in which he lived. He died on the 8th of October, 1793, in the 55th year of his age. Next man up is Rhode Island, and the one we'll note there is Elbridge Gerry. The way you pronounce his name is Gerry, not Jerry. And you're familiar with the phrase gerrymandering. And he was the governor of Massachusetts at one point. And it says Rhode Island here, but he was governor of Massachusetts at one point. And he chose to get involved in deciding how senatorial districts would be drawn. And he drew them in such a way that would favor his party. And one of the districts was so convoluted, it looked like a salamander. And so the term gerrymander evolved from that, and we've had that practice done in this country in various states since then. So this Elbridge Gerry is voted from Rhode Island. He was born in Marblehead, Massachusetts on the 17th of July of 1744. His father was a merchant in extensive business, and he resolved to give his son an excellent education. When his preparatory studies were concluded, he entered Harvard College and graduated with the title of A.B. in 1762. For some of you who graduated with a B.A., A.B. means Artium Baccalaureus, and it means a Bachelor of Arts. He soon after entered into commercial pursuits, amassed a handsome fortune, and by his intelligence and good character, won for himself the esteem of his fellow citizens. He watched with much solicitude the rapid strides which the oppressions of Great Britain were making in this country, and having expressed his sentiments fearlessly, his townsmen elected him a member of the General Court of the province in 1773. Mr. Gerry was active in all the leading political movements in Massachusetts until the war broke out. He was a member of the first provincial Congress of that province. He was one of the most efficient opposers of Governor Gage. He was a Brit. And he was a member of the provincial Congress at the time of the Battle of Bunker Hill. The night preceding that event, he and General Warren slept together in the same bed. They bade each other an affectionate farewell in the morning and separated. Mr. Gerry to go to the Congress sitting at Watertown, and Dr. Warren to be slain upon the battlefield. Now, by the way, it was this Joseph Warren. He was a major general for the colonies. He was, of course, in Boston area. He is the one who sent Paul Revere and William Dawes to Lexington to warn Hancock and Adams of the danger. And therefore, at the Battle of Breeze Hill, which is a part of the Battle of Bunker Hill, he was killed on June 17th of 1775. In January of 1776, Mr. Geary was elected a delegate to the Continental Congress, and there his commercial knowledge proved very useful, and he was put upon many committees where such knowledge was needed. He was a warm supporter of the Revolution, and therefore of Mr. Richard Henry Lee declaring the United States free and independent. And he signed his name to the Declaration on the 2nd of August following its adoption. In 1811, he was nominated for and elected Vice President of the United States. While in the performance of his duties at the seat of government, he was suddenly seized with illness and died on the 23rd of November of 1814. And that was at the age of 70. Next man up is from Connecticut. My goodness. I can't believe I left Samuel Huntington off. Oh, I see. There he is. Samuel Huntington, his bottom left. The family of Samuel Huntington was among the earlier settlers of Connecticut who located at Saybrook. He was born in Windham, Connecticut on the 2nd of July of 1732. And Samuel was very studious, and the active energies of his mind surmounted many obstacles that stood in the way of intellectual advancement. He acquired a tolerable knowledge of the Latin language, and at the age of 22 years, he commenced the study of law. Like Roger Sherman, he was obligated to pursue it with borrowed books and without an instructor. He succeeded, however, in mastering its difficulties and in obtaining a good practice in his native town before he was 30 years of age. Mr. Huntington was elected to the General Assembly of Connecticut in 1764, and the next year he was chosen a member of the council. He was appointed associate judge of the Superior Court in 1774, and in 1775 he was appointed one of the delegates from Connecticut in the General Congress. The following year, he had the glorious privilege of voting for and signing the Declaration of Independence. He was a member of the Congress nearly five consecutive years and was esteemed as one of the most active men who were there. His integrity and patriotism were stern and unbending. So conspicuous became his sound judgment and untiring industry that in 1779 he was appointed President of the Continental Congress, then the highest office in the nation. He was appointed Chief Justice of the Superior Court in his state in 1784. In 1785 he was elected Lieutenant Governor and was promoted to the Chief Magistrate Governor in 1786. That office he held until his death, which occurred at Norwich on the 5th day of January, 1796, in the 64th year of his age. Governor Huntington lived a life of irreproachable and sincere Christian, and those who knew him most intimately loved him the most affectionately. He was a thoughtful man, talked but little. The expression of his mind and heart was put forth in his actions. He seemed to have a natural timidity or modesty, which some mistook for reserve of haughtiness. Yet with those with whom he was familiar, he was free and winning in his manners. Investigation was a prominent characteristic of his mind, and when his faculty led him to a conclusion, it was difficult to turn him from the path of his determination. Hence, as a devoted Christian and a true patriot, he never swerved from duty or looked back after he had placed his hand to the work. The cultivation of this faculty of decision we would earnestly recommend to youth, for it is the strong arm that will lead them safely through many difficulties and win for them that sentiment of reliance in the minds of others, which is so essential in securing their esteem and confidence. It was this most important faculty which constituted the chief aide to Samuel Huntington in his progress from the humble calling of plowboy to the acme of official station, where true greatness was essential and to which none but the truly good could aspire. Let's take a look at the colony of New York. Now we will have Lewis Morris as our subject. He was born in Marciano, Winchester County, New York, in the year 1726. Being the eldest son, he inherited his father's manorial estate, which placed him in affluent circumstances. At the age of 16 years, he entered Yale College, and under the presidency of the excellent Reverend Mr. Clapp, he received his education. Mr. Morris was a handsome man, and his personal appearance, connected with a strong intellect and great wealth, made him popular throughout the colony. When Great Britain oppressed her people here, he hardly felt the unkind hand, yet his sympathy for others was aroused, and he was among the first to risk ease, reputation, and fortune by coalescing with the patriots of Massachusetts and in Virginia. His clear perception saw the end from the beginning, and those delusive hopes which the repeal of obnoxious acts held forth had no power over Lewis Morris. Neither could they influence his patriotism, for he was a stranger to the vacillating, temporizing spirit. And hence, when he forsook his quiet health and engaged in the party strife of the Revolution, hazarding fortune and friends, no sinister motive could be alleged for his actions, and all regarded him as a patriot without selfish alloy. He was elected to Congress in 1776, and when the question of independence came up, he boldly advocated the measure, although it seemed in opposition to his worldly interests. He plainly foresaw what actually happened: his house ruined, his farm wasted, his forest of 1,000 acres despoiled, his cattle carried off, and his family driven into exile by the invading foe. He voted for and signed the Declaration of Independence, and his state afterward thanked him for his patriotic firmness. His family seemed to be imbued with his own sentiments, for three of his sons entered the army, served with distinction, and received the approbation of Congress. Mr. Morris relinquished his seat in the National Council in 1777, but he was constantly employed in public service in his native state, either in its legislature or as a military commander, until the adoption of the Constitution. He died in January of 1978, in the 72nd year of his age. His funeral presented a large concourse of citizens who truly mourned his loss, and the military honors due to his rank of Major General were rendered when his body was committed to the family vault. Next up is New Jersey, and this is John Witherspoon. Witherspoon was born in the parish of Yester, near Edinburgh, Scotland, on the 5th of February, 1722. He was a lineal descendant of the great reformer John Knox. His father was a minister in the Scottish church at Yester and was greatly beloved. He took great pains to have the early education of his son based upon sound moral and religious principles, and early determined to fit him for the gospel ministry. His primary education was received in a school at Haddington, and at the age of 14 years, he was placed in the University of Edinburgh. He was a very diligent student, and to the delight of his father, his mind was specially directed towards sacred literature. He went through a regular theological course of study, and at the age of 22 years, he graduated as a licensed preacher. He was severally invited to take charge of a parish and the flock at Dublin in Ireland, Dundee in Scotland, and Rotterdam in Holland, but he declined them all. In 1766, he was invited by a unanimous vote of the trustees of New Jersey College, later Princeton, to become its president, but this, too, he declined, partly on account of the unwillingness of his wife to leave the land of her nativity, being strongly urged by Richard Stockton, afterward his colleague in Congress and fellow signer of the Declaration of Independence, and then on a visit to that country, he accepted the appointment and sailed to America. He arrived at Princeton with his family in August of 1768, and on the 17th of that month, he was inaugurated president of that college. Now, when the British Army invaded New Jersey, the college at Princeton was broken up, and the extensive knowledge of Dr. Witherspoon was called into play in a vastly different arena. He was called upon early in 1776 to assist in the formation of the new Constitution of New Jersey, and his patriotic sentiments and sound judgment were there so conspicuous that in June of that year he was elected a delegate to the General Congress. He had already formed a decided opinion in favor of independence, and he gave his support to the resolution declaring the states free forever. On the 2nd of August, 1776, he affixed his signature to the Declaration. Now, Dr. Witherspoon was a member of Congress from the period of the first election until 1782, and so strict was he in his attendance that it was very rare to find him absent. He was placed upon the most important committees and instructed with delicate commissions. He took conspicuous part in both military and financial matters, and his colleagues were astonished at the versatility of his knowledge. After the resolution of peace in 1783, Dr. Witherspoon withdrew from public life, except so far as his duties as a minister of the gospel brought him before his flock. As a theological writer, Dr. Witherspoon had few superiors, and as a statesman, he had first rank. In him were centered the social elements of an upright citizen, a fond parent, a just juror, an humble Christian. And on the 10th of November, 1794, at the age of nearly 73 years, his useful life closed. From Pennsylvania, we have a man by the name of Robert Morris. We're probably going to spend more time on his bio here than any of the others, and for good reason. I think you'll learn, if you don't already know, that at the end of our summation here, you will scratch your head and wonder if our freedom today was simply in the hands of a man named Robert Morris. What he accomplished during the time of the War for Independence means that without his input, without his support, without his excellent decision-making, and without his courage, we would have lost to the British. Here's his story. Robert Morris, the distinguished patriot and financier of the Revolution, was born in Lancashire, England, in January 1733. His father was a Liverpool merchant, extensively engaged in the American trade, and when Robert was a small child, he left him in the care of his grandmother, came to this country, and settled at Oxford on the eastern shore of Chesapeake Bay. He finally sent for his family, and Robert was 13 years old when he arrived. Young Morris was placed in the counting room of Mr. Charles Willing. By the way, that's the accounting department. We take care of the money and such. And he was one of the, Willing was one of the leading merchants of Philadelphia. And when Morris was 15 years old, and about the same time, he became an orphan by the sudden death of his father. Robert was greatly esteemed by Mr. Willing, who gave him every advantage his business afforded. And at the death of his master and friend, he was a finished merchant. In 1754, that's age 21, Mr. Morris formed a mercantile business partnership with Mr. Thomas Willing. the firm soon became the most extensive importing house in Philadelphia and rapidly increased in wealth and standing. But it was not until the tragedy at Lexington aroused the fiercest indignation of the colonists and extinguished all hope of reconciliation that Mr. Morris took an active part in public affairs. It is said that Mr. Morris and a number of others, members of the St. George's Society, were at dinner celebrating the anniversary of St. George's Day when the news of the Battle of Lexington reached them. If you're not familiar with St. George, I wasn't, but he is considered to be a martyr because he protected a young lady by slaying a dragon. And having done this, he became famous. They have St. George's Day. And not only that, there are St. George's societies, and it all has to do with the care and help and assistance of others. This is a Christian holiday, by the way. Now, astonishment and indignation filled the company, and they soon dispersed. So they've learned the news of Lexington. A few, after some had dispersed, remained and discussed the great question of American freedom. And there, within that festive hall, did Robert Morris and a few others, by a solemn vow, dedicate their lives, their fortunes, and their honor to the sacred cause of the Revolution. Mr. Morris was elected to Congress on the 18th of July, 1776, 14 days after the Declaration of Independence was adopted. And being in favor of the measure, he affixed his signature there too on the 2nd of August following. When Congress fled to Baltimore on the approach of the British across New Jersey, Mr. Morris, after removing his family into the country, returned to and remained in Philadelphia. Almost in despair, Washington wrote to him and informed him that to make any successful movement whatever, a considerable sum of money must be had. It was a requirement that seemed almost impossible to meet. Mr. Morris left his counting room for his lodgings in utter despondency. On his way, he met a wealthy Quaker and made known his wants. "What security canst thou give?" he asked. "My note and my honor," promptly replied Mr. Morris. The Quaker replied, "Robert, thou shalt have it." It was sent to Washington, the Delaware was crossed, and victory was won at Trenton. Many instances of a similar nature are related where the high character of Mr. Morris enabled him to procure money when the government could not, and his patriotism never faltered in inducing him to apply it to the public benefit. In 1781, upon the urgent solicitation of Congress, Mr. Morris accepted the appointment of General Financial Agent for the United States. In other words, he became the first Secretary of the Treasury. His business talent and his extensive credit at home and abroad were brought to bear in this vocation, and upon him alone, for a long time, rested the labor of supplying a famished and naked army the furnishings, other necessary supplies for the public service. Congress at that time could not have obtained a loan of $1,000. Yet Robert Morris effected loans upon his own credit of tens of thousands. It has been justly remarked that if it were not demonstrable by official records, posterity would hardly be made to believe that the campaign of 1781, which resulted in the capture of Cornwallis and virtually closed the Revolutionary War, was sustained wholly on the credit of an individual merchant. At the time, Washington was preparing his camp upon the Hudson in Westchester County to attack Sir Henry Clinton in New York. Mr. Morris and Judge Peters of Pennsylvania were then at headquarters. Washington received a letter from Count de Grasse announcing his determination not to sail for New York. Now, Francois Comte de Grasse commanded the French fleet in Chesapeake Bay, which prevented the English fleet from giving aid to Cornwallis at Yorktown. That's why that guy is important. So we salute the French this morning. At any rate, Washington received a letter from Count de Grasse announcing his determination not to sail to New York. He was bitterly disappointed, but almost before the cloud had passed from his brow, he conceived the expedition against Cornwallis at Yorktown. "What can you do for me?" said Washington to Mr. Peters. "With money, everything. Without it, nothing," he replied, and at the same time turning with anxious look toward Mr. Morris. "Let me know the sum you desire," said Mr. Morris, and before noon, Washington's plan and estimates were complete. Mr. Morris promised him the amount, and he raised it upon his own responsibility. Mr. Morris served a regular term in the United States Senate and then retired forever from public life. By his liberal expenditures and free proffers of his private obligations for the public benefit, he found his ample fortune very much diminished at the close of the hostilities. He sunk to rest in the grave on the 8th day of May of 1806, in the 73rd year of his age, leaving a widow with whom he had lived in uninterrupted domestic happiness for 37 years. Our next guy is Tom McKean from Delaware. Thomas McKean was born in New London, Chester County, Pennsylvania, in the year 1734. His father was a native of Ireland, and after receiving the usual elementary instruction, he was placed under the care of Reverend Dr. Allison and was a pupil under him. At the conclusion of his studies, he entered the office of David Finney of Newcastle as a law student, and so soon did his talents become manifest that in the course of a few months after entering upon the study of the law, he was employed as an assistant clerk of the Court of Common Pleas. In fact, he performed all the duties of the principal and was admitted to the bar before he was 21 years of age. Now, Mr. McKean was a delegate to the Stamp Act Congress in 1765 and was the associate upon a committee with James Otis and Thomas Lynch in preparing an address to the British House of Commons. And he, with his colleagues, defied the Stamp Act by using unstamped paper in their legal proceedings. Now, I want to note the footnote if you're not familiar with what was behind the Stamp Act. Here's a little blurb. Stamp Act in U.S. colonial history, first British parliamentary attempt to raise revenue through direct taxation of all commercial and legal papers, newspapers, pamphlets, cards, almanacs, and dice. Completely unexpected was the avalanche of protests from the colonists, who effectively nullified the Stamp Act by outright refusal to use the stamps, as well as by riots, stamp burning, and intimidation of colonial stamp distributors. Colonists passionately upheld their rights as Englishmen to be taxed only by their own consent through their own representative assemblies, and had been the practice for a century and a half. Now, Mr. McKean zealously opposed the encroachments of British power upon American rights, and he heartily concurred in the sentiments of the Massachusetts Circular recommending a general Congress. He was elected a delegate thereto, was present at the opening on the 5th of September, 1774, and soon became distinguished as one of the most active men in that august body. He continued a member of the Continental Congress from that time until ratification of the Treaty of Peace in 1783. Impressed with the conviction that reconciliation with Great Britain was out of the question, he zealously supported the measure which led to a final Declaration of Independence. And when that declaration was submitted to Congress for action, he voted for and signed it. Mr. McKean was claimed as a citizen of both Pennsylvania and Delaware. and he faithfully served them both, for in 1777 he was Chief Justice of the former, Pennsylvania, and President of the latter, Delaware. In addition to these offices, he was Speaker of the Delaware Assembly and Delegate to the Continental Congress. He continued in the chair of Chief Justice of Pennsylvania until 1799, a period of 20 years, when he was elected governor of the state. To this office, he was elected 3 successive terms and held it 9 years. He then withdrew to private life, where he remained until his death. This occurred on the 24th day of June of 1817, in the 84th year of his age. Next man up is Marilyn, and the man's name is Charles Carroll, and he notes the fact on the declaration that he was from Carrollton, Maryland. Details about him we can't go through right now. We don't have the time, so we'll stop a few minutes early. It'll put us back here between 15 and 10 till the hour, and we'll resume with the ninth man that will be highlighted in our reflections on those who signed the Declaration of Independence. We dismiss now for tea and crumpets.